The afterglow may linger for a while now that the big total solar eclipse is a few days behind us. The people who are in the zone of totality, have you talked to them? They describe it as something amazing and nearly indescribable. A different kind of indescribable loomed as the possibility as the eclipse approached. Oregon expected up to 1 million people to travel to the state to take part in the show in the sky. And state parks were expected to bear much of the load. So let's find out how the reality matched the expectations. Chris Havel is an associate director at ORPD, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. Thanks for joining us again, Chris.
Yeah, good morning.
So how long ago did people start reserving campsites just for the eclipse?
We allow reservations for state park campsites 9 months in advance all year long. And indeed, back in November, we opened up our first batch of reservable sites. And that starting at midnight on that day, it took about an hour for them all to get snapped up. We went back to the drawing board and came up with another 1,000 sites by converting first-come, first-serves and adding some temporary sites just for the eclipse. And we released those in April, and it took about 3 minutes for them to get snapped up. So, I think people were really looking forward to it.
3 minutes? Really? To fill, what, an additional 1,000 or so sites, you said?
Yep.
Wow. And how does this compare with any other kind of demand you've seen in the past?
Yeah, so we're a pretty popular spot for holiday camping, especially in the summer. But this, I was about to say this eclipse, that, and I don't think I'll go there.
Sounds fair. So you made some conversions, you mentioned, to some reservation stuff to be able to offer things in April. But beyond that, was there anything else that you could do? Were there any other areas you considered opening up, you know, vast meadows for camping or something like that?
Right. So that's how we came up with those extra temporary sites, is by going into our parking areas and larger open fields where we knew we wouldn't have a natural resource impact or a cultural resource impact. We had to do all of that scouting to make sure that we could use those areas safely. And that's why it took us a couple of months after November to get them all prepped. Beyond that, what we had to do was make sure that our large day-use parking areas were ready. I mean, even though they weren't going to be used overnight, we knew they were going to get hammered on Monday morning. So we did a fair bit of work making sure we had portable restrooms and hand wash stations and staff and just, you know, in general, everything in good repair and open and welcoming for people on that Monday.
So what eventually ended up being the total number of campsites, even if campsites ended up somewhat loosely defined towards the end?
Right. Yeah. It was about 3,400 across the path.
Mm-hmm. And so 3,400 across the path. What's the usual multiplier times people that you figure are going to be occupying those campsites?
Yeah, it's usually in the range of 3 to 4, depending on the nature of the event. So we figured because there were more larger groups attending that we were in somewhere in the range of 15,000 to 20,000 campers across the path.
And any indication so far whether that was about how many you got?
So we were full. We did have some people who didn't arrive on Friday as we expected, but sort of trickled in over the weekend. And there were some cases where people may be spooked by the possibility of getting stuck in a park over the weekend, didn't show up for their reservations at all. And that's in our regular campgrounds mainly. So, we were as busy as we hoped we would be and not too much more than that, which is, you know, always the concern is that you're not ready. So you tend to overplan a bit. You figure there's going to be a few more people than you can handle, so shoot for that number. And if you get less than that, then woohoo, that means you're going to have an even easier weekend.
So how much of an all-hands-on-deck situation was this as the weekend approached? I mean, were people like you in the office kind of monitoring the numbers and figuring out where things needed to be allocated if there were some last-minute needs?
Yeah, because we didn't know how easy travel was going to be, we tried to do all of that work ahead of time. So we transferred staff from outside the eclipse zone into the eclipse zone way in advance, you know, figuring out those schedules. And we did have people from our central office here deployed out to the field, in some cases right into the path of the eclipse. In other cases, they were just backfilling for staff in the field who have experience managing visitors. Backfilling for those folks. So if they were getting transferred into the path from the field, some of our office staff would go out and help replace those workers outside of the path. So, yeah, we did all of that work months ago just to be ready. And, you know, unfortunately, we had to adjust leave schedules, you know, tell employees, you know, normally this might be a time when you might take a break in before Labor Day comes. We're not going to be able to do that in many cases. So there was quite a bit of sacrifice that our employees put up to make sure that the event came off all right.
When you talk about the crush on campsites in the path, I wonder if there were places outside of it, though, that were still interesting enough. I mean, were people, for example, although right. I don't know if you could tell the difference, flocking to Harris Beach near Brookings, for example, even though they were going to get about 93% or so?
Yeah, I don't know that we saw so much of that. We certainly did see an uptick in stays at parks en route to the path. So in the week before the eclipse, places like Goose Lake down near Lakeview, right on the California border, Collier Memorial, which is north of Klamath Falls, between there and Chiloquin, and Valley of the Rogue up near Grants Pass, those are on the way too. And we saw, noticeable increases in traffic at those parks. As far as people just sort of staying put during the eclipse outside the zone, we saw the opposite, where people would find a place to stay on the periphery. And then early Monday morning, obscenely early Monday morning, they would get up and leave and go out, scout their daytime place to watch the eclipse.
Yeah, I know somebody hit the road.
There was a lot of that.
Yeah, I know somebody hit the road about 4 o'clock in the morning just to make sure they went from Bandon up to Newport.
Well, that's one of the reasons we didn't really see a tremendous spike in traffic before the eclipse. It was, all of the traffic concerns, by and large, was immediately afterward.
So how many porta-potties did you have to hire, for example?
Ooh, I think statewide we added another 250, 260, I think, something like that.
All right, which doesn't sound like a huge number, but those are going to serve, a fair number of people, dozens of people a day, right?
Oh, yes. Yep.
All right. Chris Havel, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Associate Director at the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. We're talking about the impact on the state parks and the eclipse. And, of course, the part you heard in advance was 9 months in advance when they opened up the first round of campsites for the time of the eclipse. Those went in about an hour. Then they provided some additional sites, and those went in about 3 minutes in April. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Maybe you stayed in a state park. Maybe you traveled for the eclipse. We'd like to hear from you. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The functions and facilities of state parks, Chris, obviously go way beyond camping. So what other impacts did you expect, and how did you prepare for those?
To make sure our picnic facilities were all in good shape, that our trails were clean and accessible. And, we're more than just a piece of ground. We have interpreters, educators who work in the state park system to help people connect with the landscape and really form that bond. So where we could, we also offered interpretive experiences. Here's what you're seeing and why. Here's how to do it safely. Really help people get the most out of the experience. So there was a fair bit of that. And I think, as you would expect, based on the reliability of the weather, Central Oregon attracted probably the lion's share of the visitors to the event.
No doubt. So what is the state park closest to Madras, for example?
So the Cove Palisades on Lake Billy Chinook is the largest park that's closest to that spot. But we've got little day-use parks around there, too, places that people might not have heard of. Peter Skeen Ogden Wayside, for instance, is right on 97. There's the big tall bridge there, 300 feet over the Crooked River. And that was absolutely slammed. That was where the parking lot, normally just terrific-sized for what it is, a rest area and a beautiful little picnic spot. But here, there were people pulled off along the side of the highway and causing traffic problems. And then a little unknown park called Smith Rock that maybe you've visited, maybe you haven't. That also was right at capacity from first thing in the morning all the way through. And you can actually, there's a bivouac camp, a really primitive camp right there at the park that was obviously full.
So at Peter Skeen Ogden Wayside, you can still walk across the old Highway 97 bridge, can't you?
Yeah, that's one of the wonderful things about it is, they built a new bridge. I think it's been a while now. Is it 2004, 2005, something like that. And instead of course, dismantling the old one, we just turned it into a pedestrian path. So the ODOT engineers did a terrific job from the old historic highway bridge. You get a good view of the railroad bridge and of the new bridge and a tremendous view of the gorge, you know, unlike anything that you could have gotten before they built the new bridge.
Did anybody get a picture of lots of people lying down on the pavement on the old bridge?
Yeah, I'd imagine they did. We're just now getting pictures in from some of our visitors. And that's one of the things that really stood out to us with this event is, you know, we were really keyed up and saying, come in, and it's going to be a big crowd, so we're going to have a lot of enforcement folks out. Boy, while the crowds were big, people were so pleasant. I don't mean to sound surprised about that. I shouldn't be surprised about that, but they were all in a good mood. They helped follow directions. They helped protect the park. We're waiting for reports about trash and cleanup, but at several of our parks out east, it was, you know, by the time people left, things were looking pretty good. You know, people picked up after themselves, and they really respected the landscape. So
maybe less of an impact physically than you might have thought.
Yeah, you know, even though we had the numbers, we're not really seeing the impact on the ground yet. And I don't know if it was just the nature of the event or the fact that people had been listening so well beforehand. Look, leave early, stay put. Leave late when you're done. That last part didn't work out necessarily everywhere since there was a backup from Salem all the way to Eugene and from Salem all the way to Portland right after the event.
Wow, I did see that. I-5, yeah.
Chris
Havel again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Associate Director at Oregon Parks and Recreation. We're talking about eclipse impacts. I mean, there's so much unusual about prepping for an event like this, including the fact that the Oregon State Capitol right in the path. What facilities does State Capitol State Park include?
So the parks right outside the Capitol building, everything except for the building itself and the steps, are part of a state park. So on either flank of the Capitol building, there are nice manicured lawns, fountains, monuments, displays, statues. There's even a small playground structure, sort of bronze animals that kids can jump all over and play on with a big padded surface underneath it. And then on the north side of the Capitol is a couple of fountains and just a tremendous green space that's used regularly all year, even when the legislature is not in session for events. Nothing quite this large ever before, but it's really well suited as a common gathering place for people, both to share views and to have discussions, but also just to celebrate. I mean, people, there's a basketball tournament that takes place on the street and in those parks around the area every year.
So were there scads of people hanging around the Capitol parks waiting for the moment?
Yeah, so the Oregon State Capitol Foundation actually hosted an event, and there were a couple of thousand people at that. Everything was pretty well organized. Streets were well managed. We have a terrific relationship with the city of Salem for events like that. And there, as elsewhere, things just went very, very smoothly. But, you know, they were busy, but it went terrifically.
That's good to know. Anybody have numbers yet about amounts of trash that were generated by this, or was it surprisingly less?
No, we're still waiting for that. I imagine the trash volume is where we expected it to be. It's just that it ended up in the right places rather than just scattered all over the ground. And undoubtedly, we had cleanup to do. I just don't know the extent of it yet.
Okay.
Our staff are still sort of, you know, wiping their eyes and coming out and going to work to get parks ready for Labor Day.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you don't have a whole lot of respite here before the next thing
no.
comes along.
Yep.
So could parks employees, even the ones in offices, take the time to pause and enjoy the spectacle itself?
Yes, we try to do that wherever possible. You know, I was working over at Oregon Emergency Management with the Joint Information Center there to make sure that things were running smoothly on the public information side. And, yeah, we stopped, put our glasses on, went out and enjoyed both the moments before and the moments right after totality. And it was a fantastic experience.
What memories of that moment stick with you? Well, that minute and a half, 2 minutes, I guess.
Yeah. So, you hear you're going to see stars, and it's like, well, I've seen stars before. What's the big deal? The feeling of seeing stars just for the briefest moment, and in that moment, the things that you normally wouldn't pay attention to, you do, and you really feel the power of that and the connectedness to it. I know they're just celestial bodies passing in the night, and that happens all the time. There's a total solar eclipse roughly every 18 months on the planet. So two things really sort of leapt out. Is first, you really, everything slows down for you in that moment. It only lasted 2 minutes. And while that was way too short, in the moment, it seemed like, wow, I'm really paying attention here, and I'm really connected, and that feels good when you take a moment to stop running around doing all the little stuff that you do every day and just sort of be in the moment. You remember that. And second, the knowledge that what I'm experiencing here, other people have had a chance to do with other total solar eclipses, and now I'm not just connected to sort of the arrangement of the planets, but I'm also connected to everybody else who's had that experience. And that sense is also pretty powerful. And I think now that we have something to share with people, like, hey, have you ever seen a total solar eclipse? Yeah, me too. And then you talk about that. And I think that's probably going to stay with me just as long as the site itself, you know. And I got a couple of pictures that turned out okay, but it's really the sense of the unity behind it, I think, that really stuck with me.
Everybody I've talked to about it says very similar things, that just it's beyond cool. So less than a minute left, Chris. Did the Parks and Recreation Department learn some lessons useful for future events?
Yeah, we really formed up extraordinarily strong relationships with our local first responders and emergency coordinators. It was already sort of there at a low level, but this is the first time we really had to activate those relationships. And what we learned there about how to do it and how to do it well is going to carry through many, many events, both surprise events, things like fires and floods and tsunamis and earthquakes, but also planned events like this one. So I think that was terrific. And the fact that we can trust our visitors to do the right thing, as long as we treat them with respect and give them a lot of forewarning.
Yeah, they got a lot of information up front, that is for certain. And it's nice to hear that people responded in kind. Chris Havel, is the Associate Director at Oregon Parks and Recreation, and obviously has had a major hand in taking preparations for the eclipse and all the people showing up for it in Oregon. You mentioned talking to Oregon Emergency Management. We have an interview planned with them for tomorrow morning at this time, so we'll get another look backward at what's going on with eclipse aftermath. Chris Havel, thanks again so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
My pleasure. Have a good morning.
You too.